Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Between house keys and glasses and names, there are plenty of things we wish we'd always remember. But what if you couldn't forget? My guest today recalls every detail of her life since age 14, and those memories play in her head like a movie she can't stop. Scientists say she's for real and extraordinary, and they're mining her brain for clues in treating amnesia and Alzheimer's. This hour, On Point, the woman who can't forget and what her memory means for science and maybe for you. Joining me now from New York is Jill Price. She's known in medical literature as AJ, the first formally diagnosed case of a very special class of autobiographical memory. She's 42 now. She recalls the events of every single day of her life from 1980 onward, from the mundane to the tragic, with ease. With help from writer Bart Davis, she's penned a new memoir called The Woman Who Can't Forget, the extraordinary story of living with the most remarkable memory known to science. Jill Price, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So you've got a memory that's probably different from almost all of our listeners, different from mine. How do you describe it to people?
Well, I tell them that right now, you know, I'm in the moment, but I also have a split screen in my head where I have free-flowing memories, like a movie just always running in my head.
And that is always of a particular moment. I mean, if it's running right now, you know, what we hear you speaking in the moment, what memories are going through your mind?
You know, it's so quick that I, you know, people ask and it's like, I really can't tell you, but it's just like a movie, a nonstop loop of a movie.
And you can sort of punch it into any time, any date, any moment of your life in the past since 1980 that you like?
Well, that's not how that works. It's just free flowing and it's constantly happening. But if you were to give me a specific date or if I were to read a date or see something on television, I will automatically see that day.
So, I mean, that's another remarkable thing, that it sort of goes by date. We all have memories, but not many of them are sort of date marked like a digital photograph. But if I asked you to think back to 5 years ago today, it's May 20th, 08, so May 20th, 2003, does that bring up some particular memory for you or set of memories?
Yes, it does.
Can you share any of them with us? Are there any that we might know or share, you know, collectively?
Well, I had just gotten married, and my husband and I were—well, actually, my husband wasn't feeling well that day, so I was taking care of him.
May 20th. And how do you know that's May 20th? I mean, we know in a digital photograph it's down there in the corner. How does your mind attach a date to that memory?
I don't know that. It just is the way it is.
What about popular memory from that day? You have a memory of yourself and your husband.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall, you know, memories that we might, our listeners might share? Anything else that was going on that day that everybody knew about?
Nothing comes to my mind right now.
Let's see. I'm looking here. A little thing says 93 million people tuned in for the final first run episode of Cheers on NBC. Maybe that's not a big enough deal to have even
that
made
was,
you.
That was in 1993.
That wasn't in 93.
It was in 1993,
right.
Not 2003.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So I see. So you're back 15 years there.
Mm-hmm. And, well, you asked me about 2003.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. You're quite right. I'm reading it wrong. You've got it right. But you associate that with a particular year and date. Do you remember, I don't know, that episode of Cheers?
I do. And I remember everybody hanging out of the window singing the theme song in Boston.
Do you remember what happened in an episode of Cheers? Does your memory even capture down to that detail?
That specific episode, yeah.
Can you describe it for us?
Well, I remember that Rebecca was going to marry Tom Berenger, and Sam closed the door to the bar, and somebody came at the end and knocked, and he said, "Sorry, we're closed."
Wow! Wow! Is this a blessing?
Week earlier, yeah. Knott's Landing ended their 14-year run.
Is this a blessing or a curse, Jill?
It's both.
Describe that for us. How do you weigh the positives and negatives of the kind of memory that can do what you've just done here?
The blessing is for me that I can go back as far as, well, 18 months old in the crib, but really early memories of my childhood. And that, when I think about that, that's when I how I get comfort. The flip side of that is that I don't forget all the bad things either. So if I had just done this on a specific day, then I wouldn't have done this and it wouldn't have led to this. And I don't give myself a break from that.
That's the split screen. That's the other side that's always running, and you don't get to just ignore or forget those things.
Right.
Have you tried? Can you turn off the memory or, you know, bury it if you want to?
No, it doesn't work like that. You know, you can't shut your brain off. And short of giving me a lobotomy, I don't see that there's anything that anyone can do for me.
Jill Price's new
But novel. Reaching out to the doctors, mm-hmm. that's what's given. You know, they've verified that there is something going on.
Let's talk to one of those doctors, scientists, that you reached out to. Jill Price is with us from New York. Her new memoir is The Woman Who Can't Forget, and that's her, and you hear it. A few years back, she reached out to scientists at the University of California at Irvine. One of them is with us now. Larry Cahill joins us from Irvine, California, associate professor of neurobiology and behavior. He's co-author of the 2006 paper that introduced Jill Price's extraordinary memory to science in the journal NeuroKays. Larry Cahill, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
So looking at this as a scientist, did you find this a singular memory? Is there precedent for the kind of memory that Jill Price exhibits?
No, there really wasn't, and that's why in the paper that we wrote, we felt that maybe it needed a new name, and so we coined a name to describe it. But in looking at her as we did over several years, we realized that her ability to recall pretty much, you know, the stuff of her life, we call it autobiographical memory, really was unique and far surpassed anything else that we were aware of in the literature.
And do you look at it as a, a mechanical brain phenomena, a psychological phenomena? How do you explain the source of this extraordinary memory that Jill has?
Your memory and my memory and all of your listeners' memory is a mechanical brain phenomenon. That means Jill's memory is also a mechanical brain phenomenon. So the question is, what is it that is so different about the mechanics of her brain that creates this phenomenal memory? And the real excitement for us is, if we can learn what that is, that will help teach us something not just about how her brain stores memories, but about how everybody's brain stores memories, we think.
Jill, we want to learn on the mechanical side, but, you know, the whole story that you tell is an interesting one. You describe this not as having been a memory you had from your earliest childhood days, but one that grew as you came into adolescence. Seems in part to have been triggered by a kind of trauma in adolescence when your family moved from New Jersey to California. That was very unsettling for you. Does it feel like it was psychologically provoked, induced, generated, or did it just feel like a natural mechanical capacity, Jill?
You know, I can remember my childhood between, you know, the crib and five when I lived in New York. I could remember 5 to 8 in New Jersey. I can tell you a ton of things, but I just couldn't tell you what order things fell in or what days things fell on. But when we moved to California, I feel that that move triggered something in my brain that all of a sudden I just needed to hold on to everything because I was kind of taken out of my life and plopped somewhere else. And for me, that was really unsettling, and I needed to be able to hold on to everything. And so from 8 to 14, it started to fine-tune itself where, you know, I started remembering things exactly on certain days. And by the time I was 14, and I don't really know why, February 5th, 1980, but from that day on, I could basically tell you everything.
Larry Cahill, Dr. Cahill, this sounds to an untrained ear like a kind of psychological origin, a kind of trauma, and then it became very important in maybe in emotional terms to Jill to remember, and so she did.
I think this is a question of semantics here. You're drawing what I think is an artificial distinction between mm-hmm. What you're calling a psychological event and what you're calling a mechanical event. And what I'm saying is there is no distinction. It is the neurobiology of her brain, which is what is making this happen. And that neurobiology, which you, I think, are referring to as mechanical events, might have been affected by a whole bunch of things, including the move when she was 14. So my, from my perspective as the neuroscientist, what I'm interested in is what is that neurobiology that has produced this remarkable memory, and what can we learn from that remarkable neurobiology about memory in the rest of our brains.
What's the name that you give to this phenomenon?
The name we coined is hyperthymestic syndrome, which is just a fancy name that means remarkable autobiographical memory ability.
And what do you hope to learn from Jill's case and a couple of others emerging who may be like her that may apply to people right across the board, even those who don't have this this capacity?
Well, by studying her brain and the brains, again, as you mentioned, of other people who are starting to come out of the woodwork, my email inbox is filling up daily now with people who claim to have some similar ability. By studying sort of the real exceptional cases, we hope to find things that are very different in the structure of their brain, in the neurochemistry of their brain, in the perhaps connectivity of their brain, something that would say to us, here you have a big fat clue on how it is that brains store these kinds of conscious memories. And then with that clue...
Dr. Cahill, hold the thought if you would. We'll come right back after a short break. Jill Price's new memoir is The Woman Who Can't Forget. She's with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a woman with one of the world's most extraordinary memories. She remembers, whether she wants to or not, every instant of her life and the life around her since she was 14 years old. She's 42 now. Jill Price is with us from New York. Her new memoir is The Woman Who Can't Forget, the extraordinary story of living with the most remarkable memory known to science. Dr. Larry Cahill is with us as well for a couple more minutes here from the University of California in Irvine. He co-authored the paper that first introduced Jill Price's extraordinary memory and story to the world. They're still doing a lot of work on memory and neurobiology there. Jason's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Jason, you're on the air with Jill Price.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great to have you.
Jill has already touched on it a little bit. But, you know, there's that saying, time heals all things. And I know for myself, it's a journey to forgive others who've wronged me, but it's a lot harder to forgive myself for choices I've made over the years and how it's affected me. And I'd wondered if she could elaborate a little bit on some of the tools she may use to get past that self-judgment of choices that she's made that she can remember on a moment's notice.
Yeah, it's a great question. And of course, Jill, that's very often put, time heals all wounds. If that means forgetting heals those wounds, do they never heal for you? And Jason asks how you deal with that.
Yeah, they never heal for me. For myself, I'm harder on myself, and so I still am ruminating about things from 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But when it comes to other people, I forgive, but I don't forget, and I have to somehow put it aside because I don't forget it. And I have to do that because I want to have my friends.
You mentioned earlier when we asked about 5 years ago the memory of just being married, and of course, sadly, tragically, your husband died young. And on the one hand, your memory means you can relive day after day of the time you had with him. You've dedicated the book in part to him. On the other, you can't get away from the pain associated with that loss. So, how do you keep your equilibrium in the middle of that?
I'm not sure if I'm there yet. When I think about the 2 years we were married, at this point, it's still very, very painful for me, and I can remember all of it. His death, when I think about that, I mean, I still am in the moment. The only thing that's different is that I can finish a sentence without crying, and I can also... one of the things that I was very frightened about was living without him, and I've done that. So those two things have passed, but everything else is like I'm in the moment. And every March, I relive the exact time everything happened, and from the time that I got the phone call to the time that I buried him.
Dr. Cahill, you've now found at least a couple of others, happen to be men, happen to have related to radio careers, which got my attention, who have memories which have some similar aspects to Jill's. Are there commonalities between these three people who you've identified? Do they have common traits that might support or encourage this kind of memory?
Well, that's exactly what we're looking into. They certainly all have a remarkable ability to tell you days and dates that things happened without being what's called calendar calculators. These are not people who can tell you the day of the week of any date throughout history, in essence. They pretty much can do it for the time of their life. They also have this remarkable ability, like Jill, to give you a memory from 15 years ago, kind of like the memory that the rest of us have from yesterday, and to do it in a really quick fashion. That is, as all three of them that we've studied so far will describe, the memories are just there when you ask them. There's nothing, you know, intentional. There's no mnemonic tricks going on here.
Mm-hmm.
So they all have that in common. What we're hoping to find, as I was saying before, is we're hoping to find something in their brains that they also have in common, something that's very unusual from the rest of us, be it a structure, be it a level of a neurotransmitter, what have you. Because when we find something like that, then we will have real scientific excitement. We will have a big fat clue as to how it is that their brains are doing this.
And what might, you know, if that day comes when you are able to isolate some structure or some aspect of neurobiology that explains it, is there an application for that? Are you going to help the rest of us have better memories? Or are you going to help Jill turn it off when she wants to turn it off?
All of the above. You got to remember, memory is underneath pretty much everything humans do. So the more we learn about how the brain stores memories, the better position we will be in to help pretty much everybody with a disorder of memory, ranging from the Alzheimer's patient who doesn't have enough memory to the post-traumatic stress disorder patient who has too much memory, and everybody in between.
Dr. Larry Cahill at the University of California in Irvine, one of the co-authors of the study that first introduced Jill Price's extraordinary memory to the world. I know we've got to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Hope you're doing well, Jill.
Hi, Dr. Cahill.
Bye-bye.
Let's take a quick call here from Scottsville, Virginia, and Eamon. Eamon, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I was wondering how this ability she has affects her employment, her career choices, and how she did academically. Is there an advantage to having this?
Jill Price?
I was not good in school. My rote memory was not like everybody else's, where I could. It's hard for me to memorize. So my memory is really my life and the autobiographical memories. School was very difficult. When I had to memorize poems or plays, it was excruciating. Work-wise, you know, I'm just like everyone else, so I've had a job for many, many years. I think this has helped in my organizational skills because I'm extremely organized and I run a school, so I have to be. And over the years, it's helped with that.
You've said that a part of the explicit vividness of your memory seems to be related to feeling everything very intensely, maybe the way that young people do. Does that help you relate to the young people in your school?
Well, I can remember, I sit and listen to them in the hallway, and I can feel and remember what that felt like when I was 8, 9, 10 years old.
And not
so I can relate. I can relate to them very well.
Not in a distant way, but a very immediate way. Let's get a call from Susan in Burlington, Vermont. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was interested in another correlation that Ms. Price mentioned, which was that when she was 14, which approximately correlates with puberty.
Yeah.
And there has been some research on the effects of estrogens on brain function and memory, and I'm wondering if Dr. Cahill, who I guess is no longer on the line, has explored the effects of estrogen or other hormones on memory function. And I'll take your reply off the phone.
Susan, we'll pick it up, and we'll be joined in just a moment by another neuroscientist, brain and cognitive scientist. But first, Jill, to you, you hear Susan's question. Does it make sense to you? Did it feel at the time to be related with your physical and maturation to adolescence or puberty?
You know, I never really thought about that. But my memory came into clear focus starting when I was 8. So from 8 to 14 is when I started starting to remember and exact days. And when I was 12, that's when I realized that I could remember a year ago today. But when I was 14, that's when it kind of took in high gear that it's every day. So I'm not sure, because I guess between 12 and 14, I was, you know, going through puberty.
You know, we're lucky enough to have in the studio with me right now John Gabrielli. He's professor of brain and cognitive sciences at MIT and director of the Brain Imaging Center at MIT. He studies memory, awareness, and emotion in the human brain and how they can be disrupted by nerve and mind-related disorders. Professor Gabrielli, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Many questions here, enormous issues. I mean, as Larry Cahill says and Jill makes evident, memory underlies so much of what we perceive in life. What about this question of puberty, adolescence, estrogen, memory? Is there a chemical correlation that you've found or others have?
Yeah, there's not much evidence about estrogens per se, and certainly not so dramatic. So it's we never know, but it's not likely – that's not likely to be the source of the story, because many – girls go through puberty and they don't have this remarkable memory capacity.
What about the onset of Jill's capacity in those years, though, those years of puberty? Is it, I mean, maybe there's not much to compare it here to. UC Irvine, they've only got a couple of three people that maybe fall in this category. Does it make sense to you that this memory capacity showed up at that age?
I think in many ways our brains become our adult brains around that age. Our brains are changing so dramatically in structure and function so much in early childhood that we almost don't have the same brain as when we were 3.
Wow.
But when we get to about 8 or 10, in many ways, that's the brain that we will have the rest of our lives. So in one sense, it makes sense that it's a dark period. Most of us don't remember very much specifically. It sounds like Jill does some before that. So it's in many ways, we arrive at our adult version of our brain somewhere around age 10, and maybe that's the timing factor here.
And when you hear Jill's story, are you sitting here as a specialist in this, imagining that the structure of her brain is different from yours, mine, many of our listeners? If you could look at a scan, would you expect, or maybe you've looked at Jill's brain for all I know, would you expect to see something leap out at you as a structural distinction?
So we expect to find some wonderfully fascinating difference, and it's great that Jill is partnering with the scientists to find that difference. What it will look like is very tricky, because some things pop out on brain images and some other things don't, because they're complicated about how networks are interacting in the brain. So mm-hmm. We don't know. We know if we could get inside her brain, really, we probably find that difference. But with the imaging techniques that are friendly to Jill, it might pop out, or it might take quite a bit of research to discover it.
Jill, we've got questions for you on just this front. Janelle's calling from Somerset, Massachusetts. Hi, Janelle.
Hi, Tom. Dr. Gabrielli, this kind of ties in with my question for Jill perfectly. I was wondering, Jill, if you've ever had a functional MRI or a quantitative EEG, and if you did, if it showed, you know, which areas of the brain. I know, Tom, you've had this on your show mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago. And just what it showed, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Jill, have you done it?
I did. I had a MRI the end of the summer of 2006, and they sent the scans to Harvard. And two scientists at Harvard took about 100 hours to read my scans, and they came to me in January and told me that there are regions and structures of my brain that are 3 deviations bigger than the control group that they compared me to.
So they may be, suggesting that a greater physical capacity right there built in structurally to your brain. Does that make sense to you, John Gabrielli?
Yes, it does. We have many cases where we can find some structural thing that goes with differences amongst people. This difference is a remarkable and fascinating one. And so we would expect some difference to be big in the brain, whether it's the physical size or something more about its function, how it acts. You know, the research will tell us over time.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. And Derek, hi, Derek. You're on the air with Jill Price.
Hello.
Hi.
Forgive me, I'm not blessed with the same curse, but I do remember watching a television show, and this is, I guess, just more of a comment. I think it was Johnny Carson. It's been a while, but the woman who was the redhead on the show Taxi, I remember seeing her interview, and it just always stuck with me that she had the same ability to remember. She could tell you the date of anything that happened in her life, and I don't know if that meant all the way to what age, but I do remember her saying that, and I just always thought that was odd, and now, finally, there's another person that apparently has the same dilemma.
You're talking about the television show Taxi and the Redhead. I also don't have the...
Mary Lou Henner.
Okay. Do you remember her saying that, Jill?
Yeah, I do, and I actually was watching that, and I thought
What year was that?
It was in the early 90s.
Okay.
But, you know, there are people who remember these things. The difference between that and myself is that I run my life through my head every minute of the day. And I don't know if that's what she does.
So
and that's
she,
where, mm-hmm. that's the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the torment for me. And that's why I reached out to the doctors.
So maybe she could bring it to mind, but you don't have a choice. It just comes to mind whether you like it or not.
Exactly.
Now... so if we ask you, can you then isolate what year it was, what day it was that you saw that particular show or Mary Lou Henner say that?
No, because I think it was just sitting and watching and listening to it, so I don't remember exactly.
So what makes the difference then whether you can pin it down to a particular date, a particular memory or not?
I have to be really interested in something to have seen it mm-hmm. and to have been, you know, kind of interacting in my own life.
This comes back to the emotional intensity of your perception at the time, coloring the mm-hmm. depth of your memory?
Yes.
So,
like if, mm-hmm. you know, for instance, you know, with Princess Diana dying, you mm-hmm. know, I remember that event, but I also can tell you about that weekend and what I was doing and what I was doing the week before and the week after. So it's all the same to me. There's no difference in what I was doing the day before to what was, you know, I was watching on the news.
There's been some speculation I've read that part of what you do, Jill, is maybe remember by going over these things again and again. I mean, there's no deliberate quality. You're not sort of like a curator of a museum, you know, consciously tending these memories.
No, they're just flowing in my head.
Wow. And because it's emotional, does that mean it goes most often to family events or is it most often to popular culture that's got a particular zing to it? Is there a balance?
It's usually my personal experiences that bring on the emotion.
You say in the dedication to your book that your husband, Jim, before his death, you say, made life beautiful and bearable for you.
Mm-hmm.
When you say bearable, do you mean in relationship to this burden of memory somehow?
Yeah. During the 2 years I was married, I didn't feel so tormented. I felt like he kind of balanced me and calmed me down. So this wasn't something, even though it's always been there, it wasn't something that was so tormenting to me.
John Gabrielli, do you find yourself wanting to, you know, take these things on board as a psychologist would or as a structural scientist? How do you hear that kind of observation?
Well, it's fascinating because, I mean, one thing is many of us might imagine we'd love to have this power. And I think Jill tells very movingly that it's a power that has some burden to it. And so most of us would think, gee, if we could just triple our memories for everything mm-hmm. or how easy our life would be. And I think she's very eloquent in describing the gains in terms of being able to go back to her past and the difficulties in terms of attention being drawn to the past and away from the current.
And yet Jill Price writes in her book, The Woman Who Can't Forget, that she wouldn't want to give up these memories because they are her life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a woman with one of the world's most extraordinary memories. She remembers, whether she wants to or not, every instant of her life and the life around her since she was 14 years old. Jill Price is 42 now. She's out with a new memoir called The Woman Who Can't Forget. We heard earlier from the scientists that she connected with at the University of California, Irvine, when she was looking for some answers to what's been both a blessing and a torment. John Gabrielli is also with us, a brain and cognitive sciences professor at MIT, who knows the science of this inside and out, and Jill Price, who knows the experience of it inside and out. Noreen is calling from Buffalo, New York. Noreen, you're on the air with Jill Price.
Hello. Hi. I have two questions for Jill. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that she has this movie constantly running in her head, and I wonder, how does she focus? Because I know when the television is on and I'm trying to do something, I can't focus. And the other question is, if she wakes up in the middle of the night, and like I do sometimes, I'll be thinking about what I have to do, and mm-hmm. I can't get back to sleep, and I have insomnia at that point. Well, does she keep thinking about what she did and not be able to relax and go back to sleep? So how does she focus, and does she have insomnia?
Yeah, we've got it, Noreen. Thank you. Jill, what do you say?
Well, sleeping, I have a hard time sleeping. I do have insomnia. I have had a hard time sleeping for about the last 25 years. And in fact, the only time that I slept soundly was when I was married. Focusing, I can do about 10 things at one time. So that's never been a problem. And because this is just the way it's always been, you know, I've been able to focus and be in the present when I have this movie always running in my head. And that's what people ask me. And I really don't know how I've done it.
But you'd simply develop the capacity. I guess you've had no choice. Let's turn to Nancy in Pawcatuck, Connecticut. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air with Jill Price.
Hi. This is apropos of the last question. What is your dreamlike life like? And do you get a break when you dream from this? Or does it continue while you're sleeping?
I do dream very, very vividly and very wacky dreams. And so sometimes I'd rather not go to sleep because I know that I'm just going to be having crazy dreams.
And do the dreams relate to memory more than, than your...
No, it's just like everyone else. Mm-hmm. I dream just like everyone else, but I dream in color. I dream, and I can remember them. You know, not every single dream, but when I wake up, I'm just like, oh, God, that was a crazy dream.
Maybe prefer to be in memory land, as difficult as that may be sometimes. Tom is calling from Suffolk, Virginia. Tom, you're on the air with Jill.
Well, hello. This is fascinating. Kind of a compound question for Jill. I saw a fellow on NBC Today show with the same talent a few days ago, and I was wondering if she had ever had contact with another person with this ability. And if so, is there any common thread, some commonality that makes the experience or the recall the same process?
Jill, how about it? UC Irvine has identified someone else in Wisconsin, somebody else, I think, in Ohio. Have you talked with others who have the same circumstance?
No, I have not. Nope.
Have you avoided them? Are they keeping you isolated for some reason? Would you like to speak with them?
I'm just living my life right now, so I have not been asked to meet them by the doctors.
Let's go to Richard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi. Tom, you asked an excellent question earlier about a possible psychological reason behind Jill's ability, and I would like to hear from Jill if she pursued psychological help and what came of that.
Jill?
I have been through therapy. I kind of feel like I got to a certain point and it just, you know, it didn't help anymore. But I did go through therapy for about a decade and it helped, you know, with the situations that I was dealing with at the time. But I talked to my therapist about my memory and she had absolutely no answers for me because she had never heard of this before.
Let's talk to our professor in the house, John Gabrielli. Professor, you look at memory and awareness and emotion. Does trauma figure into that? How do you see the connection between a person's psychological life and their memory life? Larry Cahill was saying earlier that maybe I was drawing a distinction without a difference between neurobiology and psychology. How do you see the interrelation? Are they the same thing?
Yeah, so Larry and I are biased. We're neuroscientists, and we think that the mind is what the brain does. And so although we're exposed in life to different things. How we respond to those things is very much set up by our prior experience, but also the way our brain is prone to operate. And so that these individual differences, how we differ one person from another, you know, you can put somebody in the same circumstance and they can have very different responses, and it doesn't have to be that traumatic. So it's – but the fascinating thing to me is the power of emotion and motivation in memory. Jill's an exceptional case, but we know in our own lives that if we're interested in something – you know, we can learn it pretty fast. And so people who know lots of things about popular culture or the baseball averages or things like that, you know, their mind can be take that up like a sponge with great fascination. And if you have to study something and you don't want to because you're preparing for an exam, learning can be very tedious and difficult. So the ability of our brain to take motivation and emotion and to turn on memories and make them powerful and vivid and absorbed very much is just a remarkable capacity of the brain.
But you're presuming, again, that it goes back to some actual physical structure in Jill's brain rather than an experience, a trauma, something that just turned on a structure we might all share.
So we think it's both of those things because we all live our lives in the world. Things happen to us. We get exposed to certain senses. But how we respond to those in many ways is set up by the way our brain is potentiated to operate. So many people move across the country. You know, that doesn't mean they'll respond having this kind of remarkable memory. So it's a lot. At some level, it's in the brain as well as in the mind, and how those fit together, that's our big challenge in the field.
Jill, how do you think about that? I can imagine many listeners thinking, well, as Dr. Gabrielli says, many people move at some point in their youth, maybe even across the country. It doesn't sound necessarily like a trauma that would change, you know, a person's brain function. I can imagine a lot of people thinking there must be some other trauma here that Jill's not remembering. I mean, we're not here to analyze you, but is it all on the table? Is there something else that could be behind this? Is there some memory that you don't have access to, or was it really just that move that got you so geared up on the memory front?
Well, that move happened when I was 8, and when we moved from New York to New Jersey when I was 5, about a year later, I said to my dad, if we ever move again, could we please take our house? Mm-hmm. So I've always felt that I was just steeped in security there, and that was where my foundation was. And that's something that I've always needed. You know, I'm somebody who should have been born, lived, and died in the same house. So I feel like for me, it was the security that I felt like I was being, upheavaled. And I have a brother who, if you ask him, he'll tell you he doesn't really remember anything from his childhood.
Wow.
Just like a lot of other people.
Right.
You know, he's normal. And so, he moved with me. So I just know that at that move, that's when everything kind of shifted for me. I know that it was because I really liked where I was living.
Mm-hmm.
My life.
One of the commonalities, if I got it right, that the scientists in California found between you and these other two men who have emerged with maybe comparable memories is you're all collectors. You know, sort of, I think maybe, was it Beanie Babies or something was your collection at one point? They had collections too. Does that make sense?
Well, I keep everything. Mm-hmm. I keep everything. You know, I still have all the dolls and the animals that stuffed animals that were given to me. I still have the first gift that was given to me when I was born. You know, I keep things. I don't hoard, but I, you know, keep things that have been important to me.
Mm. Let's take another call here from Dutchess County, New York. And Suzanne, if we can turn there. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hi. First, I hope that they'll find something that will help Jill to feel better as they're working this out. It just seems, you know, so many people can benefit from, you know, learning about her brain. But in the meantime, I hope they find some way, you know, to help her, you know, get some space from it. And that's my first feeling is, you know, that with all the things we can do, we ought to be able to relieve this for her at least part of the day.
It'd be nice.
And another thing I thought about is, like, sometimes when people are children, maybe they have wonderful hands, they have excellent dexterity, and they give them piano lessons or needlework or something, and that just gets overemphasized, and sometimes these people turn out to be the great surgeons, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to have other things going for them. But when you have a capacity for something and it's stimulated or overstimulated, it may block other areas from growing, and it also may become, if there's an emotional component, it may become, you know, disproportionately obsessive almost, because it just doesn't know how to show itself.
I mean, are you asking Jill if she feels what stunted in some other area of life? Is that it, Suzanne?
Well, no, I'm just wondering that whether any of these things could be part of the process of what happened. I think some of those things are, you know, they're there in everybody, but you know, between life experience and then sort of a need to put some control on the future. Is a way to memorize what's happening to you now, so you don't lose it. And
Jill, do you resonate with that, to Jill Price?
See, I don't memorize. That's the thing. Everything is just there, and I know it. So it's not memorizing. The one thing that I do feel is that I need to have some sort of order and control in my own life.
Have you tried drugs to give? Have you tried medication to give you relief from the memory stream?
No. I mean, I've been on meds, mm-hmm. you know, back in, you know, like maybe 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
but that did not do anything for my memory.
Wow. John Gabrielli, as you listen to this, you know, what's your impulse? Do you sort of want to race to the MRI machine and wrap it around Jill Price right away? Or, you know, what are you thinking about in terms of where this could lead neuroscience?
Of course, and I'm jealous of Larry and mm-hmm. Jim McGaugh, who are fantastic scientists, and so they'll do everything possible. But, you know, we might think memory. You have a good memory, you have a bad memory.
Mm-hmm.
And Jill's teaching us that that's not the case, because her memory for learning new things is, by her own description in school, kind of average,
mm-hmm.
you know, not remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And her capacity for remembering the past is extraordinary. So this is a huge signal about something going on in the brain that separates our memory from the past with our ability to learn new things on demand.
Mm.
Once we get those separations, those are big clues to things like treatments for diseases and stuff, because we can separate out in the brain which part of the brain is doing which part of memory. And we have very few guesses on parts of memory, and this is a big lesson about that.
Mm. Let's take a call from Carlisle, Massachusetts. And Robert, hi, Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering how comfortable Jill is with having and sharing emotions like joy and sorrow, because I wonder if that isn't an outlet for processing things that might be blocked for her.
How would that relate to the memory in your speculation, Robert?
I think often, I'm a psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and a person tends to have to overuse their mind to process things and go over things if they can't experience feelings comfortably. And I'm wondering what it's like for her to feel sadness or
Jill?
Joy.
Jill?
Share it.
Jill, what do you say?
I only know how I feel, so I don't know what it's like for anybody else. But I think that I'm probably normal in the way I feel, but my emotions are very high. Growing up, I screamed and yelled a lot, and my parents really didn't know what to do for me. But I also was somebody who kept a lot of stuff inside on the outside. Like, my parents would hear from me, but I never really talked to anybody else about things.
Do you today fear joy or sorrow because those emotional highs or lows might just imprint a moment that much more deeply on you? Does, you know, if you feel it, are you setting yourself up for yet another memory to constantly carry?
Well, I can't help to do that, but do that anyway. But I've never really thought about it like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Robert, what's your thought?
Well, I wonder if it's comfortable for her to be sad with somebody else, to share that with somebody.
You mean like a friend?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a really private person, so it just depends on the friend. But I do have friends that I can do that with.
Do you have a special set of memories, Jill, that are different from the movie that runs in your mind all the time, that you, I don't know, that you set apart as most treasured or most worrisome? Do you differentiate between memories?
The memories that are always running through my head are from my whole life, but I feel that my memories from my early childhood till about 11. Those to me are the most precious, and that's what I go to get comfort.
John Gabrielli, if we can learn something great from Jill's not always easy experience, where might it take us? What might it help us with? Could we indeed be looking at addressing Alzheimer's here or amnesia or something else?
Yeah, we don't know what path this will take. This is such a moment of discovery. Mm-hmm. But if a certain part of the brain can let you have remarkable, powerful memories of your past, of your autobiography, you know, maybe we could learn that lesson and apply it to memory loss. So it's not necessarily that we would want to strengthen, say, an Alzheimer's patient's memory for the past, but maybe that gives us a big hint about how to make it better for the future. Mm.
Jill, we've got a lot more callers here, and the common theme of those we haven't been able to get to yet is wishing you well personally. there's a lot of very warm sentiment coming through to you on the phone lines today. And
thank you.
I hope you'll take that and feel it, and hope you'll have those memories you can cherish, but somehow, someday, get relief. Do you hope for relief one day, or do you just look at this as your life, this is the way it's going to be, Jill?
This is the way it is. People ask me, would you want to be different? You know, would you want to not be able to remember? And I have been on the hunt for what the normal memory is. And from what I've gathered from other people, I wouldn't want to not remember my life.
Can't live with it. Can't live without it. Wow, what a world. Jill Price, we are grateful to you for sharing it with us today. And in your new memoir, The Woman Who Can't Forget. Good luck, Jill. Thank you very much.
And thank you. Come
talk with us again one day. Thanks for being with us.
And
John Gabrielli, Professor of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT, thank you very much for sharing your insights today.
Thank you, John.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.